I'll try my best. Joseph mentioned that the day the Dalai Lama won the Nobel Prize for Peace, he was in the middle of having a symposium that I had the good fortune to be organizing. And a friend of mine who wanted to meet the Dalai Lama had an appointment with him, and I brought him over to meet him. We spent about an hour having tea and talking. The Dalai Lama actually ended up talking about what this friend of mine was doing and how he was leading his life and how what the impact on other people was of what he did. He was a film producer. And then we left. And then a few hours later, I learned that just before we came in, the Dalai Lama had gotten a call from Norway, and he had discovered that he had won the Nobel Prize for Peace. The reason I like the Dalai Lama so much is he never mentioned it to us for the entire hour. I'm going to be talking tonight about Dharma in disguise. It's disguised as psychology. And you may be able to penetrate that disguise. I'll help you with some of my thoughts. But I'm mostly going to be speaking in the framework of Western psychology. But I'm going to be speaking about aspects of the mind and of the heart that are cultivated here during the course that you're just completing. Some years ago, I was in New York City on a very hot summer day. It was one of those really gritty, humid, uncomfortable days where people are in bad temper and no one speaks to each other, let alone looks at anyone. Everyone is grumpy. And I got on a bus to go up Madison Avenue, and something very surprising happened when I got on the bus, and that is that the bus driver, black man, middle-aged, spoke to me. He said, "Hey, how are you doing?" I was jolted out of my stupor. And I said, "Well, okay," or something. I was a little grumpy. And I sat down, and the most amazing thing happened. It turned out that this bus driver had an ongoing dialogue with basically everyone on the bus. He said, "Oh, you're looking for suits? They're having a great sale at this department store down the street. And you know this gallery we're passing? They have a wonderful Picasso show. And you see that cinema up on the left? The Cinema 1 is a crummy movie, but Cinema 2 is really pretty good." On and on and on. He went and just engaged everybody on the bus. And then people would get off, and he'd say, "Well, it's been great having you, so long." And people would say, "Yeah, right, gee, it's been great being on the bus, so long." He completely transformed people in the space of that bus ride. I think he's an urban saint, that man, going around spreading little ripples of well-being and good feeling. And that's really at the heart of what I'd like to get at this evening, which is that there is an emotional economy, an economy of the heart, which transpires and is exchanged between two people whenever they meet and interact in any way. It's the emotional subtext of an encounter, and the way it's marked is by how you feel when that encounter ends. Do you feel better or do you feel worse? In Abhidhamma, in Buddhist psychology, there's a way of looking at the mind in terms of the emotional states, the cognitive states, or they're called mental factors. Have you talked about mental factors? So I don't have to review all that? Okay. I just want to see if Joseph was listening, actually. And the list of key mental factors are the wholesome and unwholesome factors, respectively. And of course, the root wholesome factor is insight, which is the opposite of delusion, the root unwholesome factor. And the unwholesome factors include egoism, that is this kind of self-centered attitude, agitation, greed, aversion, envy, avarice, worry, contraction, torpor, and perplexity. Now, it's a wonderful list because, from my point of view, it's about emotional intelligence. Those are emotional states. We have modern vocabulary for them: anxiety, depression, anger, irritability, indecision. But the list has held basically for about 2,500 years, the same today as it was then. These mental factors, these emotional states, arise from moment to moment, as you may have noticed over the last several months. And as they arise, they act in essence as a lens on our perception. And there's a nice pithy Zen aphorism that says it very well. It says, "To her lover, a beautiful woman is a delight. To a yogi, a distraction. And to a wolf, a potential meal." So our emotional states define our reality for us from moment to moment. In describing emotional intelligence, I like to look at the neurological underpins, because I think there's some interesting new understandings coming out of brain science that have to bear on what practice is about in a very pragmatic way, particularly in terms of integrating practice into daily life. And it has to do with an understanding of how the brain evolved and the relationship between the brain centers that now dictate what we experience from moment to moment. Early on in evolution, when there were just primitive organisms, there was only what's called the brainstem. It's some structures at the top of the spine. The brainstem operates automatic things like heartbeat, how your liver metabolizes, automatic reflex. Then in evolution, there came a great breakthrough in terms of survival, which of course is the bottom line in evolution. And that was the addition to the brainstem of what we now think of as the emotional brain. It was called technically the limbic system. Limbus means ring. It's a ring of structures around the brainstem. The emotional brain added the ability to learn. And that's very important for survival, because what an early species was learning, a proto-mammal or something, was this is a good place to find grass to eat. It's a dangerous place over there. This is a poisonous plant, avoid that, and so on. Those are the things that help you survive. Also, the emotional brain had the job of answering the single most important question in evolution, and that question is this: do I eat it or does it eat me? That's not a question you want to sit around and mull over. It's a question you want to have strong, immediate, automatic responses to. So our brains are designed to have, in the emotional brain, a center which remembers, do I eat it or does it eat me? And has an immediate response based on the answer to that question, which bypasses the thinking brain. The thinking brain literally, and this is a very important thing to realize, the thinking brain literally grew from the emotional brain in evolution. It's the higher structures at the top of the brain, the neocortex. That means in a very primal way, thought is grounded in feeling. Now, there's a structure in the emotional brain. It's called the amygdala. It means walnut, which it's recently been discovered harbors all of our emotional memory. Everything in our lives that's hurt us or angered us, made us scared or fearful, disappointed us, whatever it may be, is stored in the amygdala. Only recently has it been realized that this structure, the amygdala, has a very privileged position in the design of the mind and the brain. It had been thought that when we see something and hear something, that sight and that sound goes into a structure called the thalamus, where it's converted into the language of the brain. And then from the thalamus, it goes up to sensory centers in the higher thinking brain. And the meaning of what we see or hear is analyzed, categorized, sorted out, the meaning established. And then and only then, if it has some emotional meaning, a message goes down to the emotional brain, and then we have an emotional response. This had been the conventional wisdom in neurology until about 3 or 4 years ago, with the discovery of a single neuron back alley from the amygdala, which has the emotional memory, to the thalamus, which allows everything that happens to us to be scanned as it's happening for emotional meaning. And it's scanned by a comparison of what's happened to us in the past, that is our emotional memory bank, with what's happening now. If there's a match, then the emotional brain can spring into action. Now, the interesting thing is, there's only one neuron that ties the thalamus to the amygdala. That's very fast in brain time. There are many, many neurons involved in the linkage that in the thinking brain sorts things out. What this means is that we can be emotionally hijacked before, literally before the thinking brain knows what's going on. That is, you can have an emotional response in an instant, sometimes before you know quite what's going on. Now, the emotional brain, remember, is where the rest of the brain grew, from where it grew. If the emotional brain declares an emotional emergency, this is something that makes me mad, this is something that scares me, this is something that hurts me, this is something that makes me sad, it has projections, connections, circuits to the top of the brain, throughout the brain, and in the service of survival, remember that's its job in evolution, it can hijack us in a moment and have us responding with an emotional reaction while the thinking brain is still sorting out what's going on. You can fly into a rage at someone and not quite know consciously exactly why you're so mad. Or you can suddenly get very fearful. The concept is the emotional hijack, and I'll come back to it. Emotional intelligence is a general term for how the emotional circuitry operates. Ordinarily, when we have an emotional reaction, this primitive part of the brain sends out an impulse to do something, to cry, to yell, whatever it may be. It sends it to a center just behind the forehead, prefrontal lobes, which is where we execute our actions. Ordinarily, the prefrontal lobe makes what we do appropriate. The relationship between the emotional circuitry and the higher circuitry is the emotional brain can take over the rest of the brain, except the rest of the brain, particularly prefrontal lobes, can inhibit, can say no to emotional impulse. So the prefrontal lobes have the job of saying no to impulse. And that keeps our emotions appropriate most of the time, unless the message is a very strong one. And it doesn't quite manage it well. And then we have an emotional outburst. The hallmarks of an emotional hijack are that it's very sudden, it's very intense, and when the dust settles, you feel you really blew it. Boy, why did I do that? Why did I get so upset? Why did I have that reaction? When you think about bringing the fruit of practice home to life, it's useful to understand and to think about emotional life, because it's in emotional life that most of life's little tests for Dharma practice lie, and big tests too. The first element, there are five components of emotional intelligence, and the first is self-awareness. Now, what you've been doing is cultivating self-awareness. That's what mindfulness practice is. It's a wonderful gift in life. Let me describe to you one consequence. Being aware of what you feel about things is absolutely essential to making good decisions in life. And by good decisions, I mean decisions you can happily live with. Things like, who should I marry? Should I quit this job? How should I invest my retirement funds? Every decision involves a certain kind of self-awareness, what you would call in Pali, Vedana Vipassana. That is awareness of feeling, sensation. There's a neurologist at the University of Iowa, Antonio Damasio, who describes a patient of his who had, because of a stroke, I think, he had severed the connection between the prefrontal lobes and the amygdala. Now remember, the amygdala is where working memory is. The prefrontal lobe harbors what's called working memory. When you're paying attention to something, you're holding it in working memory. What's on your mind is in working memory. Mindfulness seems to be a capacity of working memory. Everything you think about, mull over, decide, everything you learn is held first in working memory. So this man, who had been a brilliant corporate lawyer before his injury, had severed the link between working memory and emotional memory. And a very curious thing happened to him. On every test of intellectual ability, he was absolutely as sharp after the stroke as before. But his life disintegrated, deteriorated, collapsed. He lost his job. He divorced his wife. He ended up actually living in the back room of his brother's house. And he went to this neurologist to figure out what was wrong. Something clearly was wrong, but he seemed to be, you know, to have all his wits about him. So the neurologist looked into it a little more closely, and he realized that he had a peculiar incapacity. And that incapacity was that if you asked him, when should we have our next appointment, he could give you, rationally, every pro and con for every hour of every day for the next 2 weeks, yet he couldn't tell you which hour would be better. He had no feelings about his thoughts. He had no preferences. So he couldn't decide anything. The design of mind is very interesting. When we confront a moment in our lives when we have to make a decision, the mind does not give us a neat printout of the 35 previous times in our life we've experienced similar moments and what the implications rationally are for the decision we're making now. Should I marry this person? Well, here's the data on all the guys I ever dated. It's not like that. It does something much more elegant. It summates from emotional memory the emotional bottom line regarding this decision of all those 35 experiences. And it gives you that information in a gut feeling. So the ability to tune in to your deep feelings about things is absolutely crucial to making decisions in life that will keep you on course. Because what those gut feelings do is give you your wisdom about it. That's what they harbor. So when you're out of touch with that, then you don't know your feelings about things. So one way to think about, kind of a pragmatic way to think about the fruit of practice, is what kind of decisions am I making? Am I really in touch with my heart's true feelings about what I'm confronting? A second element of emotional intelligence is how you manage your moods, your feelings. Aristotle, writing, I think, just about around the time of Buddha, maybe a little after, said, anyone can get angry, that's easy. But to be angry with the right person, to the right degree, at the right time, for the right purpose, and in the right way, that's not so easy. It's still not so easy after all these years. But that speaks to how well we have what sometimes called in Buddhism skillful means. How well we manage our feelings, how well we speak up when it's appropriate to speak up or don't when it's not appropriate. The root meaning of emotion, emote, is to move. There's an impulse to act at the heart of every emotion. There's a wonderful experiment that was done at Stanford some years ago with four-year-olds. These are kids from the preschool there. They brought them into a room one by one, sat them down at a table, and put a marshmallow in front of them and said, you know, you could have this marshmallow now if you want, but if you wait till I run an errand and you don't eat it till I get back, you can have two then. Tough situation. Especially for a four-year-old. I've seen videos of these kids. They're very cute because they do everything to try to deny that that marshmallow is there. They play games over here and walk around the room and dance and sing. And one kid went up and sniffed the marshmallow. And then impulse. How do we handle our impulse? How do we handle the moments of anger or anxiety or depression in our lives? I guess here the marker on how well the accomplishments of practice are carrying into life is how you handle moments of emotional hijack. Remember, the way the brain is arranged, you cannot control what emotions you feel spontaneously. You can concoct an emotion, you can elicit emotion, but the emotions that arise spontaneously come orchestrated by the amygdala, by the emotional brain. They come to us. We can't control what we're going to feel, when we're going to feel it, or how strongly we're going to feel it. All we can control is what we do about that. What our response is. If you're caught up in an emotional hijack, the question is, how quickly do you recover? When you get back to life, it's interesting to notice what your first, the first time you lose it. Why did it happen? What was the trigger? What was my feeling and what did I do? And how long did I let it go on? Because that's the part that's voluntary. And the moment you bring mindfulness to a hijack, you already change the emotional response. You already start to loosen the hold of negative emotion on the mind. The third element of emotional intelligence is motivation, and by motivation, really what's important is how you react to setbacks and frustrations that get in the way of some goal, whatever it may be. And here the two key things are hope and optimism, which are attitudes of the mind, which are very dharmic attitudes because they allow us to face failure, setback, and go on, and not to let them dictate that we give way to despair or depression and so on. And I think that's a special case of how we do. There's a literature on people who are optimistic and those who are pessimistic. And people who are natural optimists see a setback or failure very differently from people who are pessimists. When a pessimist confronts a setback, like I saw once a study of an insurance company where a psychologist had somehow persuaded the personnel people to hire a bunch of people who wanted to be beginning sales people. Then ordinarily the people that he persuaded them to hire would have flunked the criterion, except they all scored very high in a test of optimism. Now, if you consider the task of sales in insurance, it's very thankless. You make a lot of cold calls. You call strangers up, hello, I'm from MetLife Insurance. And the answer is click. People hang up time after time after time. Each one of those setbacks is an opportunity for seeing how the mind is with it. And optimists do something very interesting. Well, pessimists take a setback like that. Oh, they hung up. They say, well, that must mean I'm no good at this. There's something wrong with me. There's something, they see themselves as flawed. They take that as a sign from the universe, confirming some deep flaw in themselves that can't be changed. Optimists see it very differently. Call, hang up, say, oh, he's having a bad day. Not my problem, his problem. In other words, they don't see it as due to something in themselves. They see it as something in the situation. It's a very process-oriented way of looking at what's going on. And if it's in the situation, then the next time is a new situation and you can try something else. You can change it, so you keep going. And in fact, the optimist who wouldn't have been hired after about 2 years had outsold all other insurance people by about 40%. It's interesting, because they kept plugging away. So those moments when we confront obstacles, setbacks, failure, are also key moments for seeing how the mind is with practice. Is it carrying over? A fourth element of emotional intelligence is empathy. And empathy means sensing not your own feelings, sensing what someone else is feeling without their having to tell you. And people almost never tell you in words what they feel anyway. They tell you in tone of voice, they tell you in facial expression, in gesture. Some people are better at empathy than others. There's a very interesting study done with married couples. In this study, a couple was invited to come into a laboratory and have a discussion. They hadn't seen each other all day, and they had two discussions. One was a kind of obligatory, how was your day, dear, talk. And the other was a 15-minute discussion about something they had a disagreement on in the relationship. While they had the discussion, they were being measured physiologically, their heartbeat and so on, and they're being videotaped. Their faces were videoed. And there's a way of analyzing these videos because we reveal our true feelings through tiny changes in facial musculature. You can tell what someone is feeling if you know the facial code. So they coded this. But they also had each partner come back separately, first the husband, then the wife, and narrate that second discussion, the disagreement, saying moment to moment what they were actually thinking and feeling during the discussion. So the husband did it and the wife did it. Then each spouse came back and watched the tape, and they're asked to watch it from their spouse's perspective. So the wife's looking at it from the husband's point of view. And they're trying to guess, what is my spouse feeling through the course of this discussion? Some people were very good at identifying what their partner was feeling during the whole course of the discussion. Some people were terrible. If you were terrible, it turned out it didn't predict very good things for the marriage, oddly enough. But the people who were empathic did something quite remarkable. And that was, as they were trying to witness this discussion from their partner's point of view, their own body mimicked physiologically the exact physiological pattern of their spouse. They were truly feeling with. And what that says is that real empathy, real listening from the heart, means that you don't get in the way. Your own feelings don't take you over. But you're really receptive to the other person. And you let their feelings come in, and what you sense as you're empathic is actually what's going on in you as a result of being so open to them. That's the secret of empathy. Empathy, of course, is the basis of caring and compassion. If you feel with someone, then you spontaneously want to help them if they're distressed. Their distress is your distress. In the unfolding of empathy in childhood, it's very interesting. Some of you may have noticed infants, little infants, if they hear another infant crying, they'll start crying as though it was themselves who were distressed. Or at a slightly older age, toddlers, if they're playing and a playmate falls down and is crying, say a two-year-old, she'll go over and get her mommy and bring her favorite blankie to her friend because she identifies so much with that friend's distress. Something very troubling, in kids who very early in life are abused or neglected, you see something very different. If they're playing and a toddler, you know, a playmate falls down and is crying, they don't go over and try to soothe them. They go over and get mad at them, and then they hit the other person. It's very disturbing. Because empathy is absolutely essential to how we are together. I have a brother-in-law who happens to be an expert on horror. He's written a book called The Essential Frankenstein and The Essential Dracula. He's actually a very nice man, a Chaucer scholar originally, but he was born in Transylvania, it's true. His name is Leonard Wolfe, and he's a wonderful man. But one point, he had decided to write a book about a serial killer. And the serial killer was named the Santa Cruz Strangler. He had killed 10 people before he was caught. His grandparents, his mother, and 7 co-eds at UC Santa Cruz. He's a very scary guy, almost 7 feet tall. At one point, Leonard was interviewing him, and he asked him really the key question. It was, how could you have done it? Didn't you have any pity for your victims? And the strangler said, very matter-of-factly, no, if I had felt any of their distress or pain, I couldn't have killed them. I couldn't have killed them. Empathy is the brake on cruelty. Now, there's a book that came out recently called On Killing, which is by a military psychologist who worked at West Point. He points out that terrorist regimes hood their victims or blindfold them. And he says the reason they do it is it's very hard to victimize or hurt someone who's looking you in the eyes. Because in the eyes, you feel what they feel. So those hoods and blindfolds are not an act of mercy for the victim, they're for the killer. To make it easier, or the torturer, to make it easier to do what they have to do. He points out that in the history of warfare, the number of casualties and deaths on the battlefield has increased in direct proportion to the distance at which you could kill someone. In the days when they said, don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes, it turns out a lot of people never fired because they saw the whites of their eyes. So how you listen, how you empathize is another mark of mindfulness in action. Do you let your own feelings get in the way? Or are you mindful? Do you manage those feelings? Do you tune into what's really going on in yourself and the other person? The fifth, the final element of emotional intelligence is, I guess, what you could call social skill. It's really about handling emotions in relationships and how well we do that. In the same study where the couples came in and they were talking about something they disagreed about, the psychologist identified a certain pattern of emotional exchange that predicted with 94% accuracy which couples would divorce within 3 years. And the pattern goes like this. One of the partners, more often the wife, because women tend to be emotional managers of relationships, feels that there's a grievance that needs to be handled, that needs to be brought up, discussed, and dealt with. And maybe she's been harboring this and brooding about it, but when she brings it up, instead of doing it in a way where this is just information to act on, like, you know, dear, when you leave your dirty socks on the bedroom floor for me to pick up, it makes me feel like you don't respect me, and I'd feel better if you picked up your own socks and put them in the laundry. She doesn't say that. She says something like this. You are the biggest slob I've ever met in my life. Now, that's not information to use. That's a personal attack. When people are personally attacked, they do what anyone would do. They get defensive because they're being attacked. So the other partner, often the husband, says, well, I picked him up last week, or some feeble thing like that. Or, you know, well, you leave dirty dishes in the sink, you know, the old counterattack gambit or something like that. But this doesn't really satisfy the partner with the original grievance. So that first partner, often the wife, will up the emotional ante because she feels she's not being heard. She's not being listened to. So she'll come back with more emotional, you're not only a slob, you're a jerk, and a da-da-da-da. And added to that is a kind of dollop of contempt or disgust, like, you know, curled lip, the sneer, rolling your eyes, oh my God. And those are actually very hurtful emotional messages from someone you love. So that often results in the person receiving the message doing what's called stonewalling. 85% of stonewallers are men. Stonewalling is, he goes back to watching TV and ignores her. Goes back to the newspaper, leaves the room. In other words, anything to end the discussion. Now, remember, these couples have their heart rate and so on monitored. What's happening is they're both in the middle of an amygdala hijack. These are two amygdalas talking or trying to work it out. And when the message of disgust or contempt comes, what that does to the husband is his heart rate can go up as much as 30 or 40 beats per second in a single heartbeat. That's a huge escalation. It's what's called flooding. You feel so overwhelmed by feeling that you want to do anything to end it. That's why stonewalling. So that's a pattern to avoid, I'd say. Really, the point is that emotions, there's an emotional subtext to every encounter. Remember, emotions are contagious. Amazing experiment. Two people come into a room, they're strangers, they've never met. Before they come into the room, they filled out a mood checklist. They sit facing each other for 2 minutes with nothing being said. Then they leave the room. They fill out the checklist again. It turns out that the more expressive of the two during those two silent minutes communicates his or her mood to the other partner. We catch emotions from each other all the time. They spread more than flus and viruses at IMS, which I understand. I guess this year was pretty good. I was in a restaurant a couple of months ago with my wife, Upper East Side, very fancy deli. And I was coming down with a cold, actually. And Tara, my wife, had ordered chicken soup. And the soup came, and I thought, gee, that looks good. It'd probably be good for me. So I thought I'd ask a waiter for a bowl and a spoon so I could have some of her soup without giving her my cold. So a waiter went by, and I said, excuse me, waiter, could I get an empty bowl and a spoon so I can share my wife's soup? And he looked at me like, I was the lowest cur he had ever seen. This was like the most outrageous thing he'd ever been asked. And he said in a very disgusted way, contemptuous way, when I have a minute. And he went on. A while later, he came back and he kind of flung the bowl down. And, you know, I felt a little toxic, actually, from that. Because of the emotions he was kind of spreading to me. I ate my soup. And toward the end of the meal, I thought it'd be really good to have some herbal tea. So this time, because of that, I waited until this waiter had gone by. I asked a different waiter. And I said, could I get some herbal tea? I'm coming down with a cold. And he said, oh, you poor thing. Oh, that, yes, you really do need some herbal tea. And here's all the different teas. And I recommend the peppermint, but we do have some teas that are high in vitamin C. And, you know, he went through the whole list. He's very concerned. And now I felt really nourished by this guy. And it was because of what the emotions he was feeding me. And also, I gave up my vow never to return to the restaurant, which had come from the first waiter. It's very interesting. There was a study done at a place called Bell Labs. It's a very high IQ R&D facility for the phone company near Princeton. And they wanted to identify who were the most productive people there. This was a place, a division with electronics engineers, and they got people to nominate the most effective and productive workers. And this is a place where they're designing equipment so complicated they work in teams of up to 150. They got a pool of 10 or 15 people that everyone agreed really were standouts. And they looked at them and they tried to figure out what's different about these people from the others. There was no difference in their intelligence. There was no difference in their academic credentials. There was no difference in years on a job, no difference in training. The difference was in these emotional capacities. These were people you liked to hang out with. These are people you trusted. These are people you got along with. So they'd run into a technical snag. They'd send an email to someone, here's my problem, can you help me? They'd get an answer back immediately. Someone else would send the same kind of question. They'd wait up to 2 weeks for the answer. See, the emotional subtext of relationships pervades our lives. And it has effects in all kinds of ways. And another use of mindfulness is to pose the ongoing question, what emotional messages am I sending along with everything else I do? In other words, it's not just our doing, it's our being. And it's asking yourself, what is the quality of my being as I'm doing this? Whatever it be, parenting or working or just with someone. Just a little bit of a larger picture on all this. The bad news about emotional intelligence is it's on the decline. That is to say, there was a national survey of more than 2,000 American kids, national random sample, rated by their parents and teachers, people that knew them really well. It was done in the mid-70s and then in the late 80s. And it turned out that over a decade and a half, kids on average got worse across the board. They were more anxious and depressed and lonely and sulky and irritable and disobedient and impulsive and so on. They went down on about 40 variables, quite an alarming pattern. They did go up on one. They all agreed that they liked team sports more. But who wants to be on a team with kids like this? See the problem. I think that this malaise, this growing malaise, is kind of behind headlines you see about tripling of suicide among teenagers in the last 20 years, quadrupling of homicide and violence, and so on. The good news, though, is that they're now realizing that there's an extended window of opportunity for helping kids get these skills mastered in the right way, that the emotional circuitry I described to you continues to develop anatomically. It's not just like you have the first 3 or 4 years of life. It continues to develop, particularly the regulatory circuits, into mid-adolescence, 15 or 16. And the way the brain shapes itself is through repeated experience. the more an experience is repeated, the stronger the circuitry for that becomes. The more you practice mindfulness, by the way, the stronger mindfulness becomes as a habit of mind. It's a neurological fact. There are now courses for kids in emotional literacy, where they teach these things from first grade to 12th grade, just like it was math or English. And when you teach it to kids, they learn it, and they have better control over their emotions and their impulse, and they get along better, they're less violent, and so on. I think that's a positive development. It's really on the fringes now. But I think that this overall deterioration also bespeaks the need for people who can model these abilities. People who are self-aware, or who do handle their emotional life well, who do empathize, who do relate to people in a way where they feel nourished at the end. Last winter, Tara and I were driving out of New York City. We were going on the West Side Highway. And if you're from New York, you know that the West Side Highway starts at street level first, and then it goes up a ramp and becomes a four-lane highway. And it was a very cold night, and it was drizzling. It was traffic jam time. It was a Friday afternoon. The cars were creeping along about 5 miles an hour. Just as we were about to go up the ramp, I was amazed to see, between the lane of traffic where I was and the lane to the left, a man in a wheelchair. He had no legs. He seemed to be, maybe he was homeless, could have been. He had a can in his lap, and he was there for money. And I just noticed him just as I was approaching. I quickly reached into my pocket, and I took out a bill. It was a $5 bill. Put in his cup, the car went on. And then I realized, just out of my peripheral vision, a gust of wind had caught that bill, taken it out of the cup, and it was on the street. And he startled awake. He'd been sleeping. He saw what happened, and he was looking helpless. He had no legs. He couldn't reach down and get the $5 bill. And now I'm watching this all in my rearview mirror. And I was amazed to see someone in the car behind me get out of the back door, walk along with the car, which was creeping along in rush hour traffic, bend down, pick that bill up, put it in the man's cup, get back in the car without missing a beat, and drive on. I don't know who that person was, but we need more like them. And I think, finally, that is really, for me, the bottom line about how practice matters in life. Are we on the spot? Are we mindful of what's going on? Are we attuned to the needs, the immediate, spontaneous needs of others? And do we respond? And for me, that's the test of mindfulness. We have a little time. If you have any questions or thoughts, welcome them. Yes? Absolutely. Women tend to be more empathic on average than men, definitely. And you know, we raise little boys and little girls very differently when it comes to emotions. Boys are raised in a way which makes them tend to tune out of emotions, and girls are raised in a way where they tend to tune in. If kids around 7, 8, 9 are playing, if it's a group of boys, the boy gets hurt and he's crying, he's expected to go to the sidelines, pull himself together. The game goes on. If it's a group of girls playing and one of them gets hurt and she's crying, the game stops and everybody gathers around and tries to help. Mothers tend to talk to their daughters about all emotions. They tend to talk to their sons mostly about handling anger. We raise boys and girls differently, so that women come into life generally, and this is just on average, it's not for everybody, but generally, more attuned to the emotional level of what's happening. That doesn't mean, by the way, that women are necessarily more emotionally intelligent than men, or vice versa, because we all have profiles of strengths and weaknesses. We can be good at self-awareness and poor at empathy and so on. Women, for example, tend to be more prone than men to what's called empathy distress. Empathy distress is when someone you really care about, really love, is really, really upset. You get that upset too. The problem with empathy distress is it means you can't be as effective sometimes in helping that person, whether it's having a good talk or finding a lawyer. And I think generally the genders have something to learn from each other. Men tend to be better, for example, at handling negative emotion than women. And I think in a good relationship, each partner helps the other and nurtures these capacities. Any other questions? Yes.
I'm wondering about what you've said about self-awareness and how that helps decision-making. And here we're taught, you know, about being okay with pleasant and unpleasant and having no preference. So I'm wondering how that impacts.
Yes, how does the teaching of having no preference jibe with having preferences? That's a question I think I'll turn over to Joseph. I think there's a kind of relative and absolute level. There's a level at which we strive to have no preference, and it's part of practice. And then there's the level at which we have to live our lives and make decisions. And I think it's at the second level that what I've talked about is operative, not the first. But Joseph probably has a different answer, which you'll hear about tomorrow night. yes, way in the back. The experiment you're talking about was done by Daniel Brown. And what it showed was that there was a sharpening of the perceptual discrimination among yogis. And what it implies for handling emotions is that if you're very mindful, you can see the emotional impulse as it begins and nip it in the bud completely and not have the emotional response at all. Particularly for distressing emotions, you know, the hijack emotions. And a mark of mindfulness is where in the trajectory of an unwholesome emotion do you A, notice it, and B, end it? If you're not mindful at all, it can be weeks, months, or years. If you're very, very mindful, it's earlier and earlier and earlier in the arc of that emotion. Till finally it's the very moment that it begins. Yes?
Those studies that were done with the developing in teenagers the ability to have the emotional intelligence, there was an implication there that it only is able to be developed at the age of 16 and not?
No, it's never too late. Not to worry. See, what I was saying was that these emotional patterns get set in the first place by age 15 or 16, but the brain continues to be plastic through life. Repeated experience through life continues to shape the brain. So if you work at cultivating a mental habit like mindfulness, that changes, basically, it literally changes the way the brain operates. If you do it consistently, if you persevere and if you practice systematically. Yes?
I've heard about an experiment which had as a result that when you have a volition, intention, that short before this moment there is a chemical reaction in the brain, which seems to be, to say that the decision, the volition, does not come from yourself, but comes from nowhere. I had during this retreat, I thought a little bit about it, but I didn't want to think too much about it. but maybe you can do my thinking.
That was an experiment done by a neurosurgeon named Libet, L-I-B-E-T, at the University of California at San Francisco during brain surgery. They don't use anesthesia during brain surgery, total anesthesia, because there are no nerve endings in the brain, for one, but also they need to keep patients awake and alert to make sure that they haven't goofed up and punctured something that's, you know, can you still, you know, count to 10 and things like that. So he took advantage of that situation and devised an ingenious method for timing thousandths of a second. And he had people do something very simple. He had them move a finger, but he was able to discriminate that the area of the brain which activates the motion to move began to activate a quarter of a second before the person first became aware of the impulse to move the finger. And then there was another maybe quarter of a second or 300ths of a second during which the person was aware of the impulse, but before the time the finger actually moved. That's absolutely critical for understanding what mindfulness adds to the repertoire, I think, because mindfulness lets you live in that second quarter second when the impulse arises, but before it's acted on. Ordinarily in awareness, people don't notice any of this, they just notice it moves. And it lets you decide, or just note the impulse and let it pass, which is what you do in mindfulness practice. And that's an absolutely invaluable skill for handling emotional life, because remember I said all emotion is impulse. It makes you want to act. And it gives you an added power of ability in managing that impulse, managing your emotional life appropriately. Yes?
When I was a child, I was taught not to get angry, but I think if I used repression instead of mindfulness.
Right.
I'm just curious as to how that is chemically or,
Well, you know, in these emotional literacy courses, they make a very interesting distinction. They tell kids, it's all right to have any emotion. So you can't control what emotion you're going to feel. You can't control anger arising because it arises outside the window of awareness initially in the amygdala reading what's in the thalamus. That's before it's gotten into the part of the brain that's aware of what's going on. So anger can arise. The question is, what do you do in the next quarter second? And I don't know that anyone can really repress or suppress anger arising, but what you can do is not let yourself act on it. Now, sometimes, as Aristotle pointed out, it's appropriate to be angry, but to be angry skillfully, which is tough. So I guess what we call emotional repression is not letting ourselves act out of anger at all. And that, like like the opposite, emotional, being very irritable and angry and expressing and acting on it, are learned habits. They're learned in childhood. Children who, you know, like those kids that have no empathy, what they've learned is to respond to distress with anger and with violence, actually. These are learned very early. I think I've lost the thread of your question. I'm not sure I answered it. Was there more?
Yes. Just about how it seemed from your talk earlier that it got there and that there was no room for repression. It seems like with repression, it goes into the body, the tension, the stopping promote other emotions as well, perhaps.
Well, it's an interesting question of whether if you feel an emotion and don't act on it, it necessarily is bad for you. I suppose it depends on the context of the emotion. Chogyam Trungpa used to say about emotions that you should never suppress an emotion, you should never repress an emotion. But if it's one of the negative emotions, you should also never act from it. Basically what he's saying is be mindful of it. I think mindfulness brings something to the table, that the mental table, that changes that dynamic so that you don't get cancer from it, but you don't make people toxic from it either. You transform it. Yes?
In your research, in your book, are you of the belief that mindfulness practice does anything, in fact, to change, you use the term changing the circuitry? Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to whether you it's just our perception that gets sharper, but whether in fact neurotransmitters, either in the amygdala or thalamus, or the connection between that and the neocortex, actually neurochemically are effective. I mean, my sense is they probably are on some level, but I'm wondering if there's any data or any intuitively what you
Intuitively, I'm certain of it. Scientifically, there's a lot of converging evidence that suggests it's probably the case. And the evidence comes from related domains. First of all, do repeated emotional lessons change brain circuitry? Answer, yes. Infants who, within the first 2 weeks of life, are identified as overly reactive to strange things. These are kids who cry real easily when a stranger comes in the room or they're confronted with something they've never seen before. Those kids, the 15% of them at the extreme, will go through life hanging back from new and novel situations. For example, they'll be shy kids. Unless their parents give them a kind of reparative experience. And that reparative experience is, from early on in life, they're encouraged to try out new and novel situations, not in a way that's going to overwhelm them, but consistently, so that they get the sense of mastery over that. Those kids, by the time they reach first grade or kindergarten, aren't shy. They're not the most outgoing kids, but they're just not shy. And that hyperreactivity to strange situations has been established to be an overreactive amygdala. And it means that certain neurotransmitter systems that trigger the amygdala fire too easily. But from what happens to those kids, you have to deduce that they no longer fire too easily. In adults, there's work with, actually, it entails mindfulness in cognitive therapy with obsessive-compulsive patients, people with very serious obsessive-compulsive disorder, like who are washing their hands 200 times a day. And they're trained to be mindful of the impulse to wash and force themselves not to act on it. And it turns out that if you do this consistently, you get over the obsessive-compulsive disorder. Now, they've used PET scans and found that if you give a person a drug, fluoxetine, who has an obsessive-compulsive disorder, they'll also stop washing their hands. And as long as they're on the drug, they won't have that compulsion. And there's this change in a particular structure, the caudate nucleus or something, I forget what, that happens when you give this drug. They also found that the people who didn't take the drug, who had the mindfulness and inhibition training, had the same change in the brain on PET scan. Interestingly enough, I just got a letter from the guy who did the research. He's a Vipassana meditator, turns out. But this is science. Well, if you've been here for the 3 months of the course, the book came out the first week in September. And as of now, it's been on the bestseller list for 10 weeks. It's a complete astounding miracle. That's what it is. So the response is massive. I got a call from a guy in Maryland, a state legislature. He wants to have a Maryland State Commission for Emotional Literacy. The head of the bar of Iowa, Bar Association of Iowa, called me. He wants to set up a project for the Bar Association to teach emotional literacy to kids from troubled families. I gave a talk at AT&T and they ordered 500 copies. It's really bizarre. So that's what happens when you disguise Dharma. People like it, turns out. Any other? Yes.
You said that when you get emotion arising and not repressing it, acknowledging it, but not repressing it, transforming it.
Well, I think the transformation comes with the act of mindfulness. The impulse wants you to do something. Mindfulness allows you to investigate what's going on, to be fully aware of it, not to suppress it, but to be more aware of it than usual, but not to let yourself be controlled by it. That's the transformation. That you're replacing the usual kind of a robotic being controlled by our emotional impulse with a full awareness of the impulse, but that awareness lets you not blindly act it out. That's the transformation, yeah.
You mentioned the fellow who was a Vipassana meditator and the difference between science and art. Could you, and it seemed, I got the sense that you pretty clearly felt that Vipassana was art and not science. Could you speak to that? What do you think the difference
is? I didn't say art, but I think it is an art. It's a good, I think it's a craft. I think it's a discipline that you master. And I think it is an inner science. I wouldn't say science and art is a contrast in the sense of creative expression, but rather inner science and outer science. Studies are done as an outer science, and mindfulness practice is part of that inner science. In fact, in Tibetan, the term for this kind of discipline translates roughly as inner science. It's a broader term, but it includes meditation practice. Yes?
The five factors of emotional
intelligence. The five factors of emotional intelligence. The American Dharma. self-awareness, managing your moods, self-motivation in the sense of hopefulness and optimism, empathy, and social skill or skillful means. You see how the translation goes. It's not skillful means, it's social skill. Well, everyone relates to social skill. That's fine. I've been on right-wing talk shows where they say, this stuff is great. We should put this on internet. Newt would love it. You know? So it translates. It translates. Yeah.
When you think it's happening, supposedly an arhat has no anger, doesn't arise.
Arhat has no anger. I know, it's very interesting. I think that there may be an ultimate remove of transformation where what where you kind of, you must massage the amygdala somehow, you know? Where, if it's true that anger doesn't arise, not even that first quarter second, that, I mean, in the brain model, is if this model applies, and it's all theoretical, highly theoretical and speculative, but if it applies, there must be a change in the response of the amygdala. There must be, it's very basic relearning of emotional pattern. Yeah, very profound. But if, I mean, it takes a lot of practice to become an arhat. So it's conceivable. Okay, fine. What do you say now? What? Oh, thank you very much.